straight into the principal's office right this minute? She'd prefer to speak with Miss Barnes, who would be more likely to believe that this wasn't a case of Ziggy simply deflecting the blame by pointing the finger at someone else. Also, Miss Barnes knew that Jane and Celeste were friends. She would know this was potentially awkward. But Miss Barnes was teaching right now. She couldn't drag her out of the classroom. She would have to email her and ask her to call. But she wanted to tell someone now. Perhaps she should go straight to Mrs. Lippman. It wasn't like Amabella was in mortal danger. Apparently the teacher's aide never took her eyes off her. Jane's impatience simply reflected her own desire to tattle. It wasn't my son, it was her son. And what about poor Celeste? Should she call her first and warn her? Was that what a good friend would do? Maybe it was. There was something awful and underhand about going behind her back. She couldn't bear it if this affected their friendship. "Come on, Mummy," said Ziggy impatiently. "Why are you just sitting there staring at nothing?" Jane undid her seatbelt and turned around to face Ziggy. "You did the right thing telling me about Max, Ziggy."
"I didn't tell you!"
Ziggy, who had already unbuckled his belt and had his hand on the car door handle ready to jump out, flung himself back around to face her. He was outraged, horrified.
Sorry, said Jane. "No, of course you didn't tell me. Definitely not."
"Because I promised Amabella I would never, ever tell anyone."
Ziggy pushed his body between the driver's seat and the passenger seat, so his anxious little face was right next to hers. She could see a smear of sticky sauce above his lip from Tom's pancakes. "That's right. You kept your promise." Jane licked her finger and tried to use it to clean his face.
"I kept my promise."
Ziggy ducked away from her finger.
"I'm good at keeping promises."
"So you remember at the orientation day?"
Jane gave up on cleaning his face. "When Amabella said that it was you who hurt her."
"Why did Amabella say it was you?"
"Max said if she told on him, he would do it again when no grown-ups were looking," said Ziggy. "So Amabella pointed at me."
He shrugged impatiently, as if he were becoming bored with the whole subject.
"She said sorry about that. I said it was okay."
"You're a very nice boy, Ziggy," said Jane. "And you're not a psychopath."
"Max is a psychopath."
"Yeah,
and I love you.
Can we go into school now?"
Ziggy put his hand back on the car door handle.
"Absolutely."
As they walked down the path toward the school, Ziggy skipped ahead, his backpack bouncing on his back, as if he didn't have a care in the world. Jane smiled at the sight of him and hurried to keep up. He hadn't been anxious because he was being bullied. He'd been anxious because he'd been bravely and foolishly carrying a secret. Even when Mrs. Lippman had accused him, her brave little soldier hadn't cracked. He'd stood firm for Amabella. Ziggy wasn't a bully. He was a hero. He was also pretty dumb for not telling on Max straight away, and because he seriously seemed to think writing down a name didn't count as telling. But he was 5, and he was a kid in desperate need of a loophole. Ziggy picked up a stick lying on the pavement and waved it over his head.
"Put down the stick, Ziggy," she called.
He tossed the stick and made a sharp right turn at the grassy alleyway leading past Mrs. Ponder's house and into the school. Jane kicked the stick off the path and followed him. What could Max have said to make a clever little girl like Amabella think that she had to keep his behavior a secret? Had he really told her he would kill her dead? And had Amabella genuinely believed that was a possibility?
she considered what she knew about Max. Apart from Max's birthmark, she couldn't differentiate between Celeste's boys. She'd thought their personalities were identical too. To her, Max and Josh were like cute, naughty little puppies. With their boundless energy and big cheeky grins, they'd always seemed like such uncomplicated children. Unlike Ziggy, who was so often unreadable and brooding. Celeste's boys seemed like the sort of children who needed to be fed and bathed and run about, physically exhausting, but not mentally draining, the way a secretive little boy like Ziggy could be. How would Celeste react when she found out what Max had done? Jane couldn't imagine. She knew exactly how Madeline would react, crazily, loudly. But she had never seen Celeste really angry with her boys. Of course she got frustrated and impatient, but she never shouted. Celeste so often seemed jumpy and preoccupied, startled by the existence of her children when they suddenly ran at her.
"Good morning. Did you sleep in this morning?"
It was Mrs. Ponder calling out from her front yard where she was watering the garden.
"We had an appointment," smiled Jane.
"So tell me, love, are you dressing up as Audrey or Elvis tomorrow night?"
Mrs. Ponder gave her a sparky, teasing grin. For a moment, Jane couldn't think what she was talking about.
"Audrey or Elvis? Oh, the trivia night."
She'd forgotten all about it. Madeline had organized a table ages ago, but that was before all the recent events. The petition, the sandpit assault.
"I'm not sure if..."
"Oh, I was teasing, love. Of course you'll go as Audrey. You've got just the figure for it. Actually, you'd look lovely with one of those short, boyish haircuts. What do they call it? A pixie cut."
"Oh," said Jane. She pulled on her ponytail.
"Thanks." "Speaking of hair, darling..."
Mrs. Ponder leaned forward confidentially.
"Ziggy is having a good old scratch there."
Mrs. Ponder said Ziggy like it was a hilarious nickname. Jane looked at Ziggy. He was vigorously scratching his head with one hand while he crouched down to examine something important he'd seen in the grass.
"Yes," she said politely.
"So what?"
"Have you checked?" said Mrs. Ponder.
"Checked for what?" Jane wondered if she was being particularly obtuse today.
"Nits," said Mrs. Ponder. "You know, head lice."
"Oh!"
Jane clapped her hand to her mouth.
"No. Do you think... Oh, I can't... Oh."
Mrs. Ponder chuckled.
"Didn't you ever have them as a child? They've been around for thousands of years."
"No. I remember one time there was an outbreak at my school, but I must have missed out. I don't like anything creepy crawly."
She shuddered.
"Oh, God."
"Well, I've had plenty of experience with the little buggers. All us nurses got them during the war. It's nothing whatsoever to do with cleanliness or hygiene, if that's what you're thinking. They're just downright annoying, that's all."
"Come here, Ziggy."
Ziggy ambled over. Mrs. Ponder broke off a small stick from a rose bush and used it to comb through Ziggy's hair.
"Nits," she said with satisfaction, in a nice, clear, loud, carrying voice.
At the exact moment that Thea came hurrying by, carrying a lunchbox.
"He's crawling with them."
Thea. Harriet had forgotten her lunchbox, and I was rushing into school to drop it off to her. I had a million things to do that day. When what do I hear?
Ziggy is crawling with nits. Yes, she took the child home, but if it weren't for Mrs. Ponder, she would have brought him into school. And why is she asking an old lady to check her child's hair in the first place? Chapter 62.
Whatever, said Abigail. No, don't say whatever. This is not a whatever type situation. This is grown-up stuff, Abigail. This is serious.
Madeline gripped the steering wheel so hard she could feel a slick of sweat beneath her palms. It was incredible, but she hadn't yelled yet. She'd gone to the high school and told Abigail's principal that there was a family emergency and she needed to bring Abigail home. Obviously, the school hadn't yet discovered Abigail's website. "Abigail is doing very well," her principal had said, all gracious smiles. "She's very creative."
"She certainly is that," said Madeline, and had managed not to throw back her head and cackle like a hysterical witch.
It had taken a Herculean effort, but she hadn't said a word when they'd gotten in the car. She hadn't screamed, "What were you thinking?" She'd waited for Abigail to speak. It seemed important, strategically. Abigail finally spoke up, defensively, her eyes on the dashboard.
"So what's this family emergency?"
Madeline said, very calmly, as calmly as Ed, "Well, Abigail, people are writing about having sex with my 14-year-old daughter on the internet." Abigail had flinched and muttered, "I knew it." Madeline had thought the involuntary flinch meant that it was going to be fine. Abigail was probably already regretting it. She'd gotten in too far out of her depth and was looking for a way out. She wanted her parents to order her to take it down.
"Darling, I understand exactly what you were trying to do," she'd said. "You're doing a publicity campaign with a hook. That's great. It's clever. But in this case, the hook is too sensational. You're not achieving what you want to achieve. People aren't thinking about the human rights violations. All they're thinking about is a 14-year-old auctioning off her virginity."
"I don't care," said Abigail. "I want to raise money. I want to raise awareness. I want to do something. I don't want to say, 'Oh, that's terrible,' and then do nothing."
"Yes, but you're not going to raise money or awareness. You're raising awareness of yourself. Abigail McKenzie, the 14-year-old who tried to auction her virginity. Nobody will care or even remember that you were doing it for charity. You're creating an online footprint for all future employers."
That's when Abigail said, ridiculously, "Whatever." As if this were all a matter of opinion.
"So tell me, Abigail, are you planning to go through with this? You do know you're below the age of consent. You're 14 years old. You're too young to be having sex."
Madeline's voice shook.
"So are those little girls, Mum," said Abigail.
Her voice shook. She had too much imagination, too much empathy. That's what Madeline had been trying to explain to Bonnie at assembly that morning. Those little girls were completely real to Abigail, and of course they were real. There was real pain in the world. Right this very moment, people were suffering unimaginable atrocities, and you couldn't close your heart completely, but you couldn't leave it wide open either, because
Otherwise, how could you possibly live your life when through pure random luck you got to live in paradise? You had to register the existence of evil, do the little that you could, and then close your mind and think about new shoes. So, we'll do something about it, said Madeline. We'll work together on some sort of awareness-building campaign. We'll get Ed involved. He knows journalists.
No, said Abigail flatly.
You'll say all this, but then you won't really do anything. You'll get busy, and then you'll forget all about it.
I promise, began Madeline. She knew there was truth in this.
No, said Abigail.
This is not actually negotiable, said Madeline. You are still a child. I will get the police involved if necessary. The website is coming down, Abigail.
Well, I'm not taking it down, said Abigail, and I'm not giving Dad the password, even if you torture me.
Oh, for God's sake, don't be so ridiculous. Now you sound like a 5-year-old, said Madeline, regretting the words even while they were coming out of her mouth. They were pulling into the kiss-and-drive zone at the primary school. Madeline could see Renata's shiny black BMW directly in front of her. The windows were too dark to see who was driving, presumably Renata's slatternly French nanny. She imagined Renata's face if she found out that Madeline's daughter was auctioning off her virginity. She'd feel sympathy. Renata wasn't a bad person. But she'd also feel just a hint of satisfaction, the same way Madeline had when she'd heard about the affair. Madeline prided herself on not caring what other people thought, but she cared about Renata thinking less of her daughter.
So, you're planning to go through with this? You're going to sleep with some stranger? Said Madeline.
She inched the car forward and tried to wave to Chloe, but she didn't see her because she was busy talking animatedly to Lily, who looked faintly bored. Chloe's skirt was hitched up by her backpack so that the entire car line could see her Minnie Mouse underpants. Madeline would normally have found that cute and funny, but at the moment it seemed somehow sinister and wrong, and she wished one of the teachers would notice and fix it.
Better than sleeping with some Year 12 guy while we're both drunk, said Abigail, with her face turned to the window.
Madeline saw Celeste's twins being separated by a teacher. They both had red, angry little faces. She remembered with a start that she was picking them up today. She was so distracted she could easily have forgotten. The car line wasn't moving because whoever was at the front of the line was having some long conversation with a teacher, as expressly forbidden by the Pirrawee Primary kiss-and-drop pick-up policy. It was probably a blonde bob, because rules obviously didn't apply to them.
But, my God, Abigail, are you thinking about the reality of this? The logistics? How will it actually work? Where is this going to happen? Are you going to meet this person at a hotel? Are you going to ask me for a lift?
Oh, Mum, I'm just off to lose my virginity. Better stop at a drugstore to buy some condoms. She looked at Abigail's profile. She had her head dropped and one hand shielding her eyes. Madeline could see her lip trembling. Of course she hadn't thought it through. She was 14.
And have you thought through what it would be like to have sex with a stranger? To have some horrible man touching you?
Abigail dropped her hand and turned her head.
Stop it, Mum! She shouted. You're in la-la land, Abigail. Are you thinking some handsome George Clooney type will take you to his villa, tenderly take your virginity, and then write out a generous check to Amnesty International? because it won't be like that. It will be vile and painful. It's vile and painful for those little girls, cried Abigail, tears sliding down her face.
But I'm not their mother,
shouted Madeline, and she slammed straight into the back of Renata's BMW. Harper.
Look, I don't want to be the one casting aspersions, but Madeline deliberately rammed Renata's car the day before the trivia night.
Chapter 63. Just don't spread the word I'm doing this. Mrs. Ponder's daughter leaned down and spoke quietly in Jane's ear beneath the cover of roaring hairdryers. Otherwise, I'll have all the posh mothers coming in here wanting me to delouse their precious little kids. At first, Mrs. Ponder had told Jane to go to the drugstore to pick up a lice treatment. It's easy, she said. You just comb through the hair and pick the little bloodsuckers. She stopped as she considered the expression on Jane's face. Tell you what, she said. I'll see if Lucy can fit you in today. Mrs. Ponder's daughter, Lucy, ran Hairway to Heaven, the very popular hairdressing salon in Pirrawee, in between the newsagent and the butcher. Jane had never been in the salon before. Apparently, Lucy and her team were responsible for all the blonde bobs on the Pirrawee Peninsula. As Lucy fastened a cape around Ziggy's neck, Jane looked around surreptitiously for any parents she might know, but she didn't recognize anyone. "Shall I give him a trim while I'm here?" asked Lucy. "Sure, thanks," said Jane. Lucy glanced at Jane. "Mum wants me to cut your hair too. She wants me to give you a pixie cut." Jane tightened her ponytail. "I don't really bother with my hair that much." "At the very least, you better let me have a check of your hair," said Lucy. "You might need a treatment yourself. Lice don't fly, but they do trapeze from head to head, like little lice acrobats." She put on a Mexican accent, and Ziggy chuckled appreciatively. "Oh, God," said Jane. Her scalp felt instantly itchy. Lucy considered Jane. She narrowed her eyes. "Have you ever seen the movie Sliding Doors? Where Gwyneth Paltrow gets all her hair cut off and it looks fantastic?" "Sure," said Jane. "Every girl loves that part." "So does every hairdresser," said Lucy. "It's like a dream job." She kept looking at Jane for a few seconds longer. Then she turned back to face Ziggy and put her hands on his shoulders. She grinned at his reflection. "You're not going to recognize your mum once I've finished with her." 'Samantha.' "I didn't recognize Jane when I first saw her at the trivia night. She had this amazing new haircut, and she was wearing black capri pants with a white shirt with the collar up and ballet flats. Oh, dear. Poor little Jane. She looked so happy at the start of the night." Chapter 64. "Celeste really did look ill," thought Madeline, as she shepherded the twins in the door. She was wearing a man's white T-shirt and checked pajama pants, and her face was dead white. "Gosh, is it some sort of virus, do you think? It came on so fast," said Madeline. "You looked perfectly fine at assembly this morning." Celeste gave a strange little laugh and put a hand to the back of her head. "Yes, it came out of nowhere." "Why don't I just take the boys back to my place for a while? Perry can pick them up from there on his way home," said Madeline. She looked at her car in the driveway.
The smashed headlight stared at her reproachfully and expensively. She'd left Abigail crying in the front seat and Fred and Chloe squabbling, and she'd also noticed Fred giving his head a good vicious scratch, and she knew from horrible experience exactly what that probably meant. It would be just absolutely marvellous if she also had to deal with a nit outbreak right now. "No, no, that's nice of you, but I'm fine," said Celeste. "I let them have unlimited screen time on Friday afternoons. They'll just be ignoring me anyway. Thank you so much for picking them up."
"Do you think you'll be okay for the trivia night tomorrow?" asked Madeline.
"Oh, I'm sure I'll be fine," said Celeste. "Perry is looking forward to it."
"All right. Well, I'd better go," said Madeline. "Abigail and I were shouting at each other in the car line, and I ran into the back of Renata's car."
"No," Celeste put her hand to her face.
"Yes, I was shouting, because Abigail is auctioning off her virginity online in a bid to stop child marriage," continued Madeline.
Celeste was the first person she'd been able to tell. She was desperate to talk about it.
"She what?"
"It's all for a good cause," said Madeline with mock nonchalance. "So I'm fine with it, of course."
"Oh, Madeline." Celeste put her hand on her arm, and Madeline felt like she might cry.
"Take a look," said Madeline. "The address is www.buymyvirginitytostopchildmarriageandsexslavery.com. Abigail refuses to take it down, even while people are writing the most disgusting things about her."
Celeste winced. "I guess it's better than prostituting herself to finance a drug addiction."
"There is that," said Madeline.
"She's making one of those grand symbolic gestures, isn't she?" mused Celeste. She pressed one hand to the back of her head again. "Like when that American woman swam the Bering Strait between the US and the USSR during the Cold War."
"What are you talking about?"
"It was in the 80s. I was at school at the time," said Celeste. "I remember thinking that it seemed so silly and pointless to swim across icy waters. But apparently it did have an effect, you know."
"So you think I should go ahead and let her sell her virginity? Is this virus making you delirious?"
Celeste blinked. She seemed to sway a little on her feet and put out a hand to the wall to steady herself.
"No, of course not," she smiled. "I just think you should be proud of her."
"Hmm," said Madeline. "Well, I think you should go and lie back down." She kissed Celeste's cool cheek goodbye. "Hope you feel better soon, and when you do, you might want to check your kids for nits."
Chapter 65. 8 hours before the trivia night. It had been raining steadily all morning, and as Jane drove back into Pirrawee, it got so heavy she had to turn up the radio and put the wipers on fast, panicky mode. She was on her way back from dropping Ziggy off at her parents' house, where he was going to stay the night so that Jane could go to the trivia night. It was an arrangement they'd made a couple of months back when the invitations for the trivia night had first come out and Madeline had gotten all excited about planning fancy dress costumes and putting together a table with the right mix of accumulated knowledge. Apparently, her ex-husband was known for his pub trivia skills. "Nathan has spent a lot of time in pubs, you see." And it was very important to Madeline that their table beat his. "And obviously it would be nice to beat Renata's table," said Madeline. "Or anyone with a gifted and talented child,
because I know they all secretly think their children inherited their genius brains from them. Madeline had said that she herself was hopeless at trivia, and Ed didn't know anything that happened after 1989. "My job will be to bring you drinks and rub your shoulders," she'd said. With all the dramas going on over the last week, Jane had told her parents she wouldn't go. Why put herself through it? Besides, it would be a kindness not to go. The petition organizers would see it as a good opportunity to collect more signatures. If she went, some poor person might find themselves in the embarrassing predicament of asking her if she'd like to sign a petition to have her own child suspended. But this morning, after an excellent night's sleep, she'd woken to the sound of rain and a strange sense of optimism. Nothing was sorted yet, but it would be. Miss Barnes had emailed back, and they'd arranged a time to meet before school on Monday morning. After the hairdresser yesterday, Jane had texted Celeste and asked her if she wanted to meet for coffee, but Celeste had replied that she was sick in bed. Jane was in two minds about whether to try to tell her about Max before Monday. The poor girl was sick. She didn't need to hear bad news. Perhaps it wasn't necessary. Celeste was too nice to let it affect their friendship. It would all be fine. The petition would discreetly disappear. Maybe once the news got out, some parents might even apologize to Jane. She would be gracious. It wasn't beyond the realm of possibility, was it? She didn't want to hand her bad mother title over to poor Celeste, but people would react differently when they knew it was Celeste's child who was the bully. There wouldn't be a petition for Max to be suspended. Rich, beautiful people weren't asked to leave anywhere. It was going to be distressing for Celeste and Perry, but Max would get the help he needed. It would all blow over. A storm in a teacup. She could stay in Pirawee and keep working at Blue Blues and drinking Tom's coffee. Everything would be fine. She knew she was prone to these bouts of crazy optimism. If a strange voice said, "Miss Chapman," on the phone, Jane's first thought was often something ridiculous and impossible, like, "Maybe I've won a car," even though she never entered competitions. She'd always quite liked this particular quirk of her personality, even when her insane optimism proved to be once again unfounded, as it invariably did. "I think I'm going to go to the trivia night after all," she told her mother on the phone.
"Good for you," said her mother. "You hold your head high."
Jane's mother had whooped when she'd heard Ziggy's revelation about Max.
"I knew all along it wasn't Ziggy," she'd cried, but so exuberantly it was obvious she must have harbored some secret doubts.
Ziggy and Jane's parents were going to spend the afternoon working on a brand new Star Wars jigsaw, in the hope of finally passing the jigsaw passion to Ziggy. The next morning, Dane was going to take him to an indoor rock climbing center, then bring him back later Sunday afternoon.
"Have some time to yourself," said Ziggy's mother.
"Relax. You deserve it." Jane was planning to catch up on laundry, pay some bills online, and do a clean out of Ziggy's room without him there to untidy as she tidied. But as she got closer to the beach, she decided to stop at Blue Blues. It would be warm and cozy. Tom would have his little potbelly stove going. Blue Blues, she realized, had begun to feel like home. She pulled up in a non-metered spot down near the boardwalk. There were no cars about. Everyone was indoors. All the Saturday morning sports would have been cancelled.
Jane looked at the passenger seat floor, where she normally kept a fold-up umbrella, and realized it was back at the apartment. Rain splattered so hard on her windshield, it was as though someone was pouring buckets of water. It looked like very determined, very wet and cold rain, the sort that would make her gasp. She put a hand to her head, considering. At least she didn't have as much hair to get wet. That was the other thing that was responsible for her good mood. Her new haircut. She pulled down the rearview mirror to study her face. "I love it," she'd told Mrs. Ponder's daughter yesterday afternoon. "I absolutely love it." "You tell everyone you see I gave you that cut," said Lucy. She couldn't believe how the short cut had transformed her face, giving her cheekbones and enlarging her eyes. The new, darker colour did something good to her skin. For the first time since before that night in the hotel, when those words had wormed their malevolent way into her head, she looked at herself in the mirror and felt uncomplicated pleasure. In fact, she couldn't stop looking at herself, sheepishly grinning and turning her head from side to side. It was embarrassing just how much genuine happiness she was gaining from something so superficial. But maybe it was natural. Normal, even. Maybe it was okay to enjoy her appearance. Maybe she didn't need to analyze it any further than that, or to think about Saxon Banks and society's obsession with beauty and youth and thinness and photoshopped models setting unrealistic expectations, and how a woman's self-worth shouldn't rest on her looks, it was what was on the inside that mattered, and blah-de-blah-blah. Enough. Today she had a new haircut, and it suited her, and that made her happy. "Oh," said her mother, when she'd seen her walk in the door, and she'd clamped her hand over her mouth and looked like she might burst into tears. "You don't like it," said Jane, putting a self-conscious hand to her head, suddenly doubting herself. And her mother had said, "Jane, you silly girl, you look gorgeous." Jane put her hand on the keys in the ignition. She should go back home. It was ridiculous to go out in the rain. But she had such an irrational craving for blue blues and everything about it. The smell, the warmth, the coffee. Also, she wanted Tom to see her new haircut. Gay men noticed haircuts. She took a deep breath, opened the car door, and ran. Chapter 66. Celeste woke late to the sound of rain and classical music. The house smelled of bacon and eggs. It meant that Perry was downstairs in the kitchen with both boys sitting up on the island bench in their pajamas, legs swinging, crazy happy faces. They adored cooking with their father. Once, she'd read an article about how every relationship had its own love account. Doing something kind for your partner was like a deposit. A negative comment was a withdrawal. The trick was to keep your account in credit. Slamming your wife's head against a wall was a very large withdrawal. Getting up early with the kids and making bacon and eggs was a deposit. She pulled herself upright and felt the back of her head. It still felt tender, but it was okay. It was amazing how fast the healing and forgetting process had begun again. The cycle was endless. Tonight was the trivia night. She and Perry would dress up as Audrey Hepburn and Elvis Presley. Perry had ordered his Elvis outfit online from a premium costume supplier in London. If Prince Harry wanted to dress up as Elvis, he would probably get his outfit there. Everyone else would be wearing polyester and props from the $2 shop. Tomorrow, Perry was flying to Hawaii. It was a junket, he admitted. He'd asked her a few months back if she'd wanted to go with him, and for a moment she'd seriously considered it, as that might be the answer. A tropical holiday. Cocktails and spa treatments. Away from the stress of day-to-day life. What could go wrong? Things could go wrong. He had hit her once in a 5-star hotel because she'd teased him about his mispronunciation of the word menial. She would never forget the horrified humiliation on his face when he realized he'd been mispronouncing a word his whole life. While he was in Hawaii, she would move herself and the boys into the McMahon's Point apartment. She would make an appointment with a family lawyer. That would be easy. The legal world wasn't scary to her. She knew lots of people. It would be fine. It would be awful, of course, but it would be fine. He wasn't going to kill her. She was always so dramatic after they had an argument. It seemed especially silly to use a word like kill while her supposed killer was downstairs frying eggs with her children. It would be terrible for a while, but then it would be fine. The boys could still make breakfast with Daddy when they had their weekends with him. Yesterday was the last time he would hurt her. It was over.
Mummy, we've made breakfast for you.
The boys came running in, scrabbling up on the bed next to her like eager little crabs. Perry appeared at the door with a plate balanced high on his bunched together fingertips, like a waiter in a fine dining establishment. Yum, said Celeste.
Chapter 67.
I know what to do, said Ed.
No, you don't, said Madeline.
They were sitting at the living room table, listening to the rain and gloomily eating Jane's muffins.
It was terrible the way she kept giving them to Madeline, as if she were on a mission to urgently expand Madeline's waistline.
Abigail was in her bedroom, lying on the sofa bed they'd moved in to replace her beautiful 4-poster bed. She had headphones on and was lying on her side with her knees up to her chest. The website was still up. Abigail's virginity was still available for purchase anywhere in the world. Madeline had a grimy, exposed feeling, as if the eyes of the world were peering in her windows, as though strange men were right now silently creeping down her hallway to leer and sneer at her daughter. Last night Nathan had come over, and he and Madeline had sat with Abigail for over 2 hours, begging, reasoning, cajoling, yelling, crying. It had been Nathan who cried, finally, with frustration, and Abigail had been visibly shocked, but the ridiculous child still would not budge. She would not give them the password. She would not take it down. She might or might not go ahead with the auction, but that wasn't really the point, she said. They needed to stop obsessing over the sex part. She was leaving the website up to raise awareness of the issue, and because she was the only voice those little girls have. The egocentricity of the child, as if international aid organizations were sitting around twiddling their thumbs while little Abigail McKenzie on the Piriwee Peninsula was the only one taking decisive action. Abigail said she couldn't care less about the horrible sexual comments. Those people were nothing to her. That was completely irrelevant.
People were always writing mean stuff on the internet.
Don't suggest calling the police, said Madeline to Ed now. I really don't.
We contact the Australian Office of Amnesty International, said Ed. They don't want their name associated with something like this. If the organisation that really does represent the rights of these girls tells her to take it down, she'll listen.
Madeline pointed her finger at him.
That's good. That might actually work. There were bangs and crashes from down the hallway. Fred and Chloe did not respond well to being stuck indoors on a rainy day.
Give it back! Screamed Chloe. No way! Shouted Fred.
They came running into the room, both of them gripping a sheet of scrap paper.
Please don't tell me you're fighting over that piece of paper, said Ed.
He's not sharing, screamed Chloe. Sharing is caring.
You get what you get, and you don't get upset, screamed Fred.
In normal circumstances, that would have made Madeline laugh.
It's my paper airplane, said Fred.
I drew the passengers. You did not.
Well, you can stop all your stressing.
Madeline turned to see Abigail leaning against the door jamb.
What?
She said. Abigail said something that Madeline couldn't hear over the yelling of Fred and Chloe.
Bloody hell!
Madeline snatched the piece of paper from Fred's hand and tore it in half, handing them a piece each.
Now get out of my sight, she roared.
They ran.
I've taken down the website, said Abigail with a world-weary sigh.
You have? Why?
Madeline resisted the urge to throw her arms above her head and run around in circles like Fred did when he kicked a goal.
Abigail handed her a printout of an email.
I got this.
Ed and Madeline read it together. To Abigail McKenzie from Larry Fitzgerald. Subject, auction bid. Dear Miss McKenzie, my name is Larry Fitzgerald, and it's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. You probably don't hear from many 83-year-old gentlemen living on the other side of the world in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. My darling wife and I visited Australia many years ago in 1987, before you were born. We had the pleasure of seeing the Sydney Opera House. I'm an architect, since retired, and it had always been a dream of mine to see the Opera House. The people of Australia were so kind and warm to us. Sadly, my beautiful wife passed away last year. I miss her every day. Miss McKenzie, when I came across your website, I was moved by your obvious passion and your desire to bring attention to the plight of these children. I would not like to purchase your virginity. However, I would like to make a bid. This is what I propose. If you close your auction immediately, I will make an immediate donation of $100,000 to Amnesty International. I will, of course, send you a receipt. I have spent many years campaigning against the abuse of human rights, and I do so admire what you are trying to achieve. But you are a child yourself, Miss McKenzie, and I cannot, in good conscience, stand by and see you take this project to fruition. I look forward to hearing whether my bid is successful. Yours sincerely, Larry Fitzgerald. Madeline and Ed looked at each other and over at Abigail.
I thought $100,000 was quite a big donation, said Abigail.
She was standing at the open fridge as she talked, pulling out containers, opening lids and peering into them. And that Amnesty could probably do something, you know, pretty good with that money.
I'm sure they could, said Ed neutrally.
I've written back to him and told him I've taken it down, said Abigail. If he doesn't send back the receipt, I'm going to put it straight back up.
Naturally, murmured Ed. He's got to follow through.
Madeline grinned at Ed and then back at Abigail. You could see the relief coursing through her daughter's young body. Her bare feet were doing a little dance as she stood at the refrigerator. Abigail had put herself in a corner, and the wonderful Larry Fitzgerald of South Dakota had given her an out.
Is this spaghetti bolognese? Said Abigail, holding up a Tupperware container. I'm starving.
I thought you were vegan now, said Madeline.
Not when I'm staying here, said Abigail, taking the container over to the microwave. It's too hard to be vegan here.
So tell me, said Madeline, what was your password?
I can just change it again, said Abigail.
I know.
You'll never guess, said Abigail.
I know that, said Madeline. Your father and I tried everything.
No, said Abigail. That's it. That's my password. You'll never guess.
Clever, said Madeline.
Thanks.
Abigail dimpled at her. The microwave dinged, and Abigail opened the door and took out the container.
You know that there are going to have to be, consequences for all this, said Madeline. When your father and I expressly ask you to do something, you can't just ignore us.
Yep, said Abigail cheerfully. Do what you gotta do, Mum. Ed cleared his throat, but Madeline shook her head at him.
Can I eat this in the family room while I watch TV?
Abigail lifted the steaming plate. Sure, said Madeline. Abigail virtually skipped off. Ed leaned back in his chair with his hands crossed behind his head. Crisis averted. All thanks to Mr. Larry Fitzgerald. Madeline picked up the email printout. How lucky was... She paused and tapped a finger to her lips. Just how lucky was that?
Chapter 68. There was a closed sign on the door of Blue Blues. Jane pressed her hand to the glass door and felt bereft. She couldn't remember ever seeing a closed sign at Blue Blues before. She'd just gotten herself completely, ridiculously, extravagantly soaked for nothing. She dragged her palm down the glass and swore. Right. Well, she'd go home and have a shower. If only the hot water at her apartment lasted for more than 2 minutes and 27 seconds. 2 minutes and 27 seconds was not long enough to get yourself warm. It was just long enough to be cruel. She turned to go back to the car. Jane! The door swung open. Tom was wearing a long-sleeved white T-shirt and jeans. He looked extremely dry and warm and delicious. In her mind, Tom was always associated with good coffee and good food, so she had a Pavlovian response just looking at him.
You're closed, said Jane dolefully. You're never closed.
Tom put his dry hand on her wet arm and pulled her inside. I'm open for you. Jane looked down at herself,
Her shoes were filled with water. She made squelching noises as she walked. Water rolled down her face, like tears.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I didn't have an umbrella, and I thought if I just ran really fast..."
"Don't worry about it. Happens all the time. People walk through fire and flood for my coffee," said Tom. "Come out back, and I'll get you some dry clothes." I decided I might as well close up and watch TV. I haven't had a customer in hours. "Where's my man Ziggy?"
"Mum and Dad are babysitting, so I can go to the school trivia night," said Jane.
"Wild night out."
"It probably will be," said Tom. "Pirouette parents like a drink or two."
"I'm going. Did you know?
Madeline has gotten me on your table."
Jane followed him through the cafe, leaving wet footprints, and to the door marked private. She knew that Tom lived at the back of the cafe, but she'd never been past the private door.
"Ooh," she said as Tom opened the door for her. "Exciting."
"Yes," said Tom. "You're a lucky, lucky girl." She looked around her and saw that his studio apartment was just like an extension of the cafe. The same polished floorboards and rough white walls. Bookshelves filled with second-hand books. The only differences were the surfboard and guitar leaning against the wall, the stack of CDs and stereo.
"I can't believe it," said Jane.
"What?" smiled Tom.
"You're into jigsaws," she breathed, pointing at a half-finished jigsaw on the table.
She looked at the box. It was a proper hardcore, as her brother would have said, 2,000-piece jigsaw featuring a black-and-white photo of wartime Paris.
"We jigsaw," said Jane. "My family. We're kind of obsessed."
"I like to always have one on the go," said Tom. "I find them sort of meditative."
"Exactly," said Jane.
"Tell you what," said Tom.
"I'll give you some clothes, and you can have some pumpkin soup with me and help me jigsaw."
He pulled some tracksuit pants and a hooded sweatshirt from a chest of drawers, and she went into his bathroom and put her soaked clothes, right down to her underwear, into his sink. The dry clothes smelled like Tom and blue blues.
"I feel like Charlie Chaplin," she said, with the sleeves hanging below her wrists, and pulling up the waist of the tracksuit pants.
"Here," said Tom, and he neatly folded up the sleeves of the shirt above her wrists. Jane submitted like a child. She felt unaccountably happy. Cherished. She sat down at the table, and Tom brought them over bowls of pumpkin soup, swirled with sour cream and buttered sourdough bread.
"I feel like you're always feeding me," said Jane.
"You need feeding," said Tom. "Eat up." She took a mouthful of the sweet, spicy soup.
"I know what's different about you," said Tom suddenly. "You've had all your hair cut off. It looks great."
Jane laughed. "I was thinking on the way here that a gay man would notice straight away that I'd had a haircut." She picked up a piece of the puzzle and found a spot for it. It felt like being at home, eating and doing a puzzle. "Sorry, I know that's a terrible cliche."
Said Tom.
"What?" said Jane. She looked up at him. "That's where it goes. Look. It's the corner of the tank."
"This soup is incredible. Why don't you have it on the menu?"
"I'm not gay," said Tom.
"Oh, yes, you are," said Jane merrily.
She assumed he was making a bad sort of joke.
"No," said Tom. "No, I'm not."
"What?" I know I do jigsaws and make amazing pumpkin soup, but I'm actually straight.
Oh, said Jane. She could feel her face turning crimson